Okay, this is an important lecture today. As a matter of fact, it's probably only the today I'll probably only be able to get through the first half of this lecture, and I'll probably finish up talking about this 1949 to 1954 period on Friday. But let me begin by trying to place this episode in the context of the course as a whole. What are we trying to do in this course? We're trying to understand how international politics works, how great power politics works, and we're trying to do that by looking at the great conflicts of the 20th century, First World War, the Second World War, the Cold War, through the lens of international relations theory. In other words, our goal is to look at these episodes, very important episodes, with a prepared mind, so that we can get some insight into these fundamental issues that international relations theorists are concerned with. All right. And this part of the course, the second part of the course, our focus is on the Cold War. And we're trying to understand how the Cold War should be viewed. There's a common view that the Cold War is to be understood in ideological terms, the liberal West versus the totalitarian communist East. Given those ideological differences, conflict is inevitable. And against that view, there's the kind of realist view that says, well, countries' policies cannot simply be based on ideology. They have to worry about their survival. They have to worry about what would happen in a war. So power considerations have to be brought into account. You can't ignore power considerations. They play a fundamental role. And in this case, these fundamental power political considerations were bound to lead both sides to more or less accept the post-war status quo, to pull in their horns, because for each of them, the status quo was vastly preferable to a new war. Each of them would more or less agree to live with things as they were. Right? That's the basic rule. That's the basic rule about how the two sides could live with each other in the nuclear age. Okay? If you buy that way of looking at things, right away you can see that there's a puzzle. Because if that were the case, how can you explain the Cold War? Why was there this great political conflict? If both sides understood that they had no choice but to live with things as they were, where was the problem? Why should there be a risk of war? Right? Fundamental problem. So you go back in the historical sources and you try and see how these issues were dealt with. And one of the most amazing things is when you look at the immediate post-World War II period, is that both sides were thinking in power political terms. Both sides seemed ready to accept the division of Europe, to accept that Eastern Europe, including Eastern Germany, would be a Soviet sphere of influence, whereas Western Europe, including Western Germany, would lie within the Western sphere, and the United States being by far the most important of the Western powers. Two sides would each call the shots in each side of Europe. The two sides should be able to get along with each other. That was the heart of the understanding that Stalin and Burns reached at Potsdam, and it was confirmed by the course of events in the second half of the year, culminating in the Moscow conference in December of 1945. Again, all right, but what that did was it simply underscored the seriousness of the problem. You know, if both sides were willing to abide by that rule about how they can get along, why was there all this tension in 1946? Okay, that's a big puzzle. Okay, how are we to understand what happened following in early 1946, all right? If there is this rule that both sides generally accept, basically accept, about how they can get along in the future, each side controlling things in its own sphere of influence in Europe, if there's that general rule, then it follows that when you do have problems, those problems have to do with some exception to that general rule, right? And what is that exception? It's not Poland or Romania. You know, the Americans had acquiesced in Soviet, you know, domination of those areas. Not France or Belgium or Holland or Italy. Right, Soviet Union has no problem with having those countries in the Western sphere. There's one and only one problem. This is the problem of West Germany. Because whereas in general the Soviets could allow the Americans and their friends to call the shots in Western Europe, they couldn't give them a total free hand, total carte blanche, to set policy in the western part of Germany. Why not? Because if West Germany became too independent and too strong, too free to build up its military power, even West German resources were such that that powerful West German state could pose a real threat to Soviet control of the East and possibly even pose a real threat of triggering a Third World War. Because whereas Britain, France, and the United States had no trouble, in principle, accepting the division of Europe, okay, you can't say the same thing about the Germans. They couldn't look with equanimity on communist rule over half of their country, having 20 million of their compatriots under Soviet rule, etc. They were bound to want to change the status quo. You know, as long as they were dependent on the Western powers for protection, there wasn't much they could do about it. They would have to kind of acquiesce. But as soon as they became strong, as soon as they became able to stand on their own in military terms, oh, you couldn't say that anymore. There might be real trouble. And if that was down there at the end of the road, well, you wanted to nip the problem in the bud before it became totally unmanageable. Right? So you have this conflict over Germany. You know, the one great exception to that rule. And we saw how it was dealt with and how there was a spiral dynamic there. How the Western powers, in order to win the Germans over and get the Germans to integrate themselves into the Western camp, how they had to kind of play up to the Germans, promise them, you know, that they would eventually recover their political rights, help them build up their military power, and so on. All these things frightened the Soviets. The Soviets resorted to countermeasures. But the more threatening the Soviets became, the more important it was for the Western powers to pay whatever price was needed to get the Germans to side with the West, and so on and so on. That dynamic of 1946-1947, pivoting on what was called the Western strategy for Germany. And then finally, we saw how at the end of 1947, the Western governments, especially the American government, had somewhat reluctantly come to the conclusion that they had no choice but to continue pursuing the Western strategy to its logical limits. In other words, creating a West German state, a state that would be organized under the auspices of the Western powers and tied to the West economically, politically, ultimately, militarily, right? Soviets, and so you have international politics in this period, 48-49, proceeding along these three separate but interrelated tracks. The policy that was adopted at the London Conference in December 47, creating a West German state, the process leading to the establishment of a West German state, which came into being in April of 1949, Federal Republic of Germany, not fully independent, still under the occupation. There was, in fact, this occupation statute that was promulgated at the same time. Okay. The process leading to the establishment of the Federal Republic of Germany, the Soviet reaction, which was the Berlin blockade, also begins at the same month, June of 1948, same month as the London recommendations, the decision to set up a process that will lead to the establishment of West German state. The London recommendations were adopted. A couple of weeks later, you have the Berlin blockade. Very clear from everything, and it was universally understood at the time, that the Berlin blockade was not about the city of Berlin. It was not an attempt to kick the Western powers out of Berlin, but rather to use Berlin as a lever for getting the Western powers to rethink their entire German policy. Okay, it's their Achilles heel. You remember the map, you know, Berlin is this land island in the middle of communist East Germany, very easy to cut off access. And yet the Soviets didn't want to a war at this point. They weren't even particularly interested in kicking the West out of Berlin. I should say, incidentally, that the Western presence in West Berlin, the fact that it's the West's Achilles heel, that's not to the interest of the West. It's the interest of the Soviets. They have a very effective means of putting pressure on the West. So why would they want to kick us out? All right. So you have the Berlin blockade as the response to the decision to create a West German state. The Soviets are basically saying, our views have to be taken into account. You can't exclude us in this way. You can't, this is a very fundamental political interest for us. Let's talk. And then the Western response to that, by blockading Berlin and ignoring our fundamental right to be there in Berlin, the Soviets are showing that they're are willing to pursue a quite hostile policy, a policy that could conceivably lead to war, and we have nothing in place that could defend Western Europe in the event of war, except for the prospect of a long, one-sided air atomic war, which we would win in the end, but it would be a Pyrrhic victory because Europe, Western Europe, would be devastated in the process, right? And so both sides are held back, but the Americans realize we got to put some sort of military system in place here. We have to create some sort of counterweight to Soviet power on the ground in Europe, right? We need something better than simply a tripwire strategy. And so, this is the third of these three interrelated tracks, the track leading to the creation of the North Atlantic Treaty Organization, NATO. And the NATO treaty is also signed April of 1949, a product of these negotiations about European security and about America's involvement in the protection of Western Europe. Because it would be American power, American military power, that would be the backbone of any security system that was put in place in Europe. Right? Three interrelated tracks. And the whole process runs its course in the space of that year, from June of 48 to April of 49, basically. Yeah. The Federal Republic of Germany brought into being. West German state, tied to the West, brought into being. The Berlin blockade liquidated, implying that, you know, the Soviets no longer view the policy of putting pressure on the West via Berlin as fruitful. And the creation of the North Atlantic Treaty Organization, NATO Treaty, also the spring of 1949. Okay? And so you look at this stuff and you say, all right, well, there were problems, isn't it the case that a relatively stable system has finally taken shape? The Soviets might not have liked the fact that the West was creating a West German state, but they've accommodated to it. They've acquiesced in it. They realize that they have no choice but to accept it, both sides now understand that the system based on the division of Europe is perfectly stable. They're willing to live with it. You should have a nice, peaceful world. But again, it doesn't happen because the very next year, again, you have this great crisis. As I was saying, I think it's like the most serious crisis of the Cold War period, the most serious crisis of the nuclear age, the crisis of the winter of 1950-51. You know, the more serious even than the Berlin and Cuban crises of the 61-62 period. This 50-51 crisis, there was a real risk of a general war. The world came much closer to it, I think, than it did even during the Cuban Missile Crisis. But we'll talk about this stuff. What's the basic framework here for analysis? We've identified the core problem, the taproot problem of the Cold War period, the German problem. Okay. Whether you're going to have war or peace depends on whether you, stability or instability, put it that way, depends on whether you could reach an understanding between East and West about Germany. Okay. That's the core problem. It seemed at Potsdam that they were on the verge of reaching that kind of agreement. Right? That's the meaning of the Burns Plan. You know, there was a real understanding between Stalin and Burns about how the two sides should conduct themselves in the post-war period. Yeah, the strategy of the amicable divorce, all that sort of thing. And we looked at why that didn't work. And then we come to the second chance for peace. 1949, it seemed formal division of Europe. It's all these structures are put in place, NATO, the two German states, all this kind of thing. Okay? And it doesn't work. Why doesn't it work, right? And then at the probably the end of the lecture next time, I'm going to talk about the 1954 system. Again, this is a chance for peace. It seemed like a structure had been worked out that both sides could live with, and yet you go into this new period of crisis just a few years later with the opening of the Great Berlin Crisis in November of 1958, central episode of the Cold War, a crisis which will culminate in the Cuban Missile Crisis in October of 1962, right? Three attempts. You could say creating a stable international system, each of them fails. Right? That's the basic structure. Three false dawns, each of which turns out to be something of a mirage. They don't work. Why don't they work? That's the focus of our analysis. And then finally, 1963, after the Cuban Missile Crisis, you have a third chance for peace, a third period in which it seemed that the two sides could reach an understanding. And the important thing about that is that it did work. It did lay the basis for what was to be a very stable system for the balance of the Cold War. All right. Three false dawns and one true one. That's the structure. Okay, so today we're looking at number two, right? Formal division of Europe into spheres of influence. Formal structures in place. Okay. Why doesn't it work? The answer there is very straightforward. It doesn't work because the two sides had not reached a genuine political accommodation. Right? There had been no genuine meeting of the minds about how far you're going to go with West Germany, how strong West Germany was going to be. Right? Soviet fears about a process just beginning that could lead to very dire consequences in the end, those fears were still intact. But they can no longer pursue a policy based on giving expression to those fears, because they were as yet not strong enough to do it, right? No political understanding. If the policy was being shelved, you know, put in the icebox, That was for military reasons, not political. And what was the military situation? Okay, the key to understanding what happened in 49-50 is to understand the military structure that was in place at the time. Okay. I was mentioning before about the Berlin blockade. Neither side wanted a war. As a matter of fact, and both sides knew that the other side didn't want a war either. And there were these kind of bizarre things about the Berlin blockade, you know? It's like the Soviets are actually cooperating with the airlift, even though the airlift was designed to enable Berlin to survive despite the blockade. They cooperated in the management of the traffic into the air traffic into the city by continuing to participate in the Berlin air traffic center. And they refrained from jamming the radars that were needed to guide the trains and planes into the city. And those radars are very important because of the kind of weather you have in Berlin, in fact, throughout that part of Europe during half the year, winter time, basically. Okay, they don't want to drive the West out of Berlin. They're using it as a lever. They don't want a war. Neither side wants a war. Okay, why don't they want a war? Because if war breaks out, yeah, they'll be able to overrun all of Europe up to the Atlantic. But that's not going to end the war. The Americans are going to gear up and start building bombs and bombers. They don't have many bombs and bombers in place at this point. These are early atomic bombs, relatively limited power. Hard to know what targets to hit. Hard to deploy the delivery systems needed to bomb Soviet targets. Okay. If in the first offensive, they couldn't do more than bruise the Soviets, right? In the words of people who've analyzed these things. Okay. But that's just the beginning. It doesn't mean the United States was powerless. The war breaks out, and then you start gearing up to fight it in a serious way. You start, producing, lots of bombs and lots of bombers. And if it's a one-sided war, you could take your time. You're going to win in the end. The Soviet Union is going to be utterly destroyed. They can't do anything like that to us as long as they don't have nuclear weapons. Okay? So the outcome of the war is clear. The United States is going to win. The Soviet Union is going to be totally destroyed. It might take 5 years, 10 years, but the outcome is essentially inevitable. Okay? That's the... So the Soviets are held back by the prospect that America would be able to do that. Until August 29th, 1949, when they break the American nuclear monopoly. But as long as we have the nuclear monopoly, we don't have to, divert a massive resources to the construction of a huge military force. We can rely on the deterrent effect. We can rely on a tripwire strategy. Right? We could, rechannel resources away from the military toward, civilian uses, et cetera, et cetera. What resources we devote to the rest of the world, they could focus on the economic rebuilding of Western Europe, the Marshall Plan, and so on. But no large military force. All right, that was the policy of the late 40s. Low military spending, even in the nuclear area, was never full speed ahead in terms of producing these nuclear weapons. Okay, saying we wouldn't want a war because Western Europe would be overrun. They don't want a war during this period because even though they would have these successes at the outset, they would be destroyed in the course of the war. Neither side wants it. Both sides are held back. A balance, a tenuous balance between East and West in this period up to August 29th, 1949. But at that point, everything changes overnight, because this the American nuclear monopoly is the only thing that's balancing massive Soviet land power on the continent. And now, if a war breaks out, we can't just take our sweet time and gear up after the outbreak of the war and fight the war with weapons produced after it begins, knowing that the outcome is very clear. We're bound to win in the end. Why can't we do that? Because the entire equation gets changed once the Soviets develop a nuclear capability. Okay? Time becomes a crucial factor. Okay? Once they're able to deploy any forces that are capable of attacking the United States and use those forces to destroy the American air atomic infrastructure. Now, that, by that I mean the plants that are building bombs, and there aren't many of them, and their locations are well known, and the main aircraft building facilities. If they're able to attack those targets, we won't be able to prevent them from building more bombs and more aircraft themselves, and from going on to develop a general air atomic superiority that they can use to destroy our whole military industrial base, and more quickly than we would be able to do the same sort of thing to them. Right? People say, oh, but the Soviets had no way of attacking the United States in that period. Not true. They were able to attack American targets with the bombers that they had on one-way missions, you know, and the pilot would just continue flying the plane and parachute down over Mexico or something, right? They had the bombers that are perfectly capable of doing that. As a matter of fact, these were copies of the American B-29. A B-29 had been forced to land on Soviet territory during the war. The Soviets basically took it apart, saw how it worked, and built a copy of it. Right. So they had the ability to attack American targets. Limited ability, but there weren't a great number of targets either. Once they destroyed our ability to kind of really hurt them, then there was nothing to keep them from building more bombs and more bombers and just continuing to prevent the United States from doing any damage to them and destroying the United States in the process. Right? So it's a race. All of these problems having to do with the limited power of the forces that were in being in the late 40s, that didn't matter much if you could take your sweet time. Now they became much more serious. And what are these problems? The problems are overseas bases secure? Because if you really want to hurt them, the bombing campaign has to be intense. And to fight that campaign, you need these medium bombers that fly back and forth, have a lot more missions than these intercontinental bombers, which we had, which, you know, were huge, more easily shot down, there were a lot fewer of them, and so on. So you can conduct a much more intense bombing campaign with medium bombers based places like Britain and Japan and so on than you could with long-range heavy bombers, the B-36 it was called in those days. Okay? Air defense was much more important than it had been. Because the ability, target intelligence was much more important than it had been, right? Because it's the effectiveness of these initial campaigns. Which side could wipe out the other's air atomic infrastructure faster? These things which side would succeed in that would depend on all these things. How good is your target intelligence? Well, the United States is open society. Everyone knows where these nuclear production facilities are, and so on. Soviet Union, we don't have any decent intelligence on them at all. We had these kind of aerial photography that we had gotten from the Germans. The Germans had taken pictures of the Soviet military infrastructure during the war, but that was, you know, it's out of date. It's not terribly good. They had certain advantages. So much so that our fear was, as soon as the nuclear monopoly was broken, that if a new war broke out, we might be in danger of losing. That's almost a verbatim quote from some comments that the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, Army General Omar Bradley, made in the National Security Council. This is secret stuff in November of 1950. We're scared that we might lose. Conversely, the other side feels like, well, this is actually from a letter that Stalin sent to the Chinese leader Mao Zedong at exactly that same time, in November of 1950 or October of 1950. I don't remember exactly when, but he said, "If war is inevitable, let it happen now." A window of opportunity had opened up for the Soviets. Right? If war is inevitable, why should they wait? Why should they allow the process of the rearmament of Germany and Japan and including those countries into a more and more powerful Western bloc to run its course? The Soviets, thanks to America's negligence in terms of its military forces in the late 1940s, had a window of opportunity. They might win if war broke out. America didn't have many atomic weapons. America was vulnerable to a Soviet attack with these bombers that were sent on one-way missions and so on. War is inevitable. Let it happen now. Now, within the American government, all this was understood. The implications of the loss of American nuclear monopoly were very clear from the outset. Prior to the outbreak of the Korean War in June of 1950, we understood that America would be in a very difficult position because we hadn't rearmed. We had very little in terms of forces and being. The Soviets might be tempted to bring matters to a head before it was too late. And that that we could be entering into a very dangerous period. Some very interesting documents from March, April of 1950 that show that key American figures were thinking along those lines. They didn't know, they expected an upsurge of Soviet aggressiveness, partly to kind of take advantage of American weakness in an opportunistic way, but maybe even influenced by the calculation that if a general war broke out, that wouldn't be too bad from the Soviet standpoint, that they had a good chance of winning. And when the Korean War did break out in June, and you will know that the Soviets basically green-lighted the North Korean attack on South Korea in June of 1950, the Korean War was interpreted in the context of that general assessment. You know, this shows that these people are pursuing a more aggressive policy now that they've broken the American nuclear monopoly. Well, the Korean War, as such, you could argue about what it meant, because the Americans, conscious of their own military weakness, had been pursuing a very mild policy with regard to areas like Korea, from 1947 on, especially in early 1950. We don't want to risk war over this. Secretary of State Dean Acheson gives a famous, or I should say infamous, speech in early 1950, making it clear that South Korea lay outside the American defense perimeter. So you could say that this is like an engraved invitation to the communists to invade South Korea, right? It's like they could practically sue us for breach of promise when we then send military forces to South Korea after having said it lies outside our defense perimeter. Yes.
Earlier when you said, though, even if war surged, they still had a chance of winning, did you mean the Americans still had a chance?
I'm sorry, what did I say?
Earlier when you said that there is still a chance of winning, did you mean the Americans?
No, the Soviets have the chance of winning. It's the Soviets might very well win a war that breaks out in 1950 or 51. This is a window of opportunity for them. It's a window of vulnerability for us. And that kind of window thinking, they didn't use the term windows, that was coined much later, but that kind of thinking plays a very powerful role in American thinking during this period. Okay. Okay. So this is a dangerous period. So what are we supposed to do? I finish the thought about the North Korean invasion of South Korea. That's not the crucial episode in this regard. That's not what really scares people. What scares people is what happens in October, especially November of 1950, the Chinese communist intervention in the war. Because after the North Korean invasion, we reverse our policy. Right, this whole business of North Korea, of South Korea lying outside the American defense perimeter, it's as though that policy didn't exist. Because the aggression is so blatant that we feel, oh, we can't sit on our hands. So we do intervene militarily in the Korean War, and we drive the North Koreans back toward, across the 38th parallel, and in fact, toward the Chinese border. And the Chinese then intervene toward the end of the year. And not only do they intervene, but they push the Americans not just out of North Korea, but they're threatening to push the Americans out of the entire Korean Peninsula. Right? This is much scarier than the North Korean attack, because the North Korean attack, you could say, well, it was based on what they had understood American policy to be, opportunistic. Here, the Chinese intervention shows that they're consciously willing to risk a new world war, because the sense on the communist side is that they're in the driver's seat. They're strong. America's weak, right? This is scary stuff. I mean, the defeats that were inflicted on the American army by the Chinese during this period, during the winter of 50-51. These are the blackest moments in American military history. Never suffered such reverses, right? What are you going to do about this? You know, this is frightening stuff. And there's all this evidence that comes from intelligence sources of various sorts, especially through the East Europeans, but also examining what the Soviets are doing in terms of preparation for a major conflict. It really seems like we're on the verge of a third world war here in the winter of 50-51. It really could happen. What do you do? How do you deal with that problem? You say, oh, we don't want to provoke these people. No, that was not the American reaction. Not 100% in any event. They didn't want to provoke in terms of expansion of the Korean War, that's for sure. But in other ways, they were pursuing a policy that they knew would increase the risk of war. And in two very major ways. One is the massive, absolutely unprecedented rearming effort that was made by the United States during this period. And the key thing here is a document called NSC 68/4. This is not the famous NSC 68, this is another document. NSC 68/4, adopted in December of 1950, which laid out a basic program for massive across-the-board rearmament. You know, in the nuclear area, both strategic and tactical, aircraft, weapons, you know, the whole thing. In the non-nuclear area, you know, big buildup of conventional forces, you know, quadrupling of the military budget, you know, unprecedented, given that the United States was not fighting a general war here, and that most of the buildup, a very, very, very small part of this buildup, had to do with the Korean War proper. Right. This was an extraordinary buildup, and it had the effect of utterly transforming the balance. But it took a long time for that to happen. Those two points. Why did it take a long time? But why was it so dramatic in terms of its impact on the balance when it finally did come? The answer to both of those questions has to do with the fact that the world is living through a period of extraordinary, revolutionary change in military technology. And you could begin with the atomic area. This is there are all these breakthroughs in the design of fission weapons. These low yield atomic bombs become lighter. The yield to weight ratio becomes much greater, so that these very effective atomic munitions can be carried on navy fighter bomber carrier based aircraft and so on. You didn't need to rely on these massive heavy bombers, of course. Very expensive to produce, hard to deploy, and so on. So you had a dramatic change in the design of fission weapons. The beginning first of what are called boosted fission weapons, where a slight fusion reaction was triggered by the fission explosive to increase the yield. And then finally true thermonuclear weapons in 1952. With yields 1,000 times as great as the bombs that were dropped on Japan at the end of the war. You know, a dramatic change in that area. Dramatic change in terms of delivery systems. This is the period when propeller aircraft are being replaced by jet aircraft. And it goes, it just goes on and on. This is the beginnings of military computerization. Where, you know, see all you with your computers. I mean, do you know that why computers were developed? They were developed for military purposes. You know, and these electronic computers, which came online, especially in the early 1950s, were first deployed. The first major system that they were deployed in was the SAGE air defense system. Air defense being considered, for the reasons I was talking about before, is of fundamental importance. All these things. It took an awfully long time to re-equip your military with all this advanced technology. You had to kind of work out all of these designs and then retool your factories and develop the kind of equipment you needed to produce these weapons. You had to train the soldiers in their use, and all this stuff takes a very long time. But and it wasn't until 1952, in fact, the second half of 1952, that these things had worked their way into military end products capable of being used by the forces in the field, right? But when that happened, it just meant the military balance had been just utterly transformed. Because the Soviets, all they had was this massive pile of junk in comparison with what we had. All their stuff, World War II vintage armaments, they couldn't compete with these extremely modern American weapons, right? So now it was the United States that had very much the upper hand. Right. That was late 52. But people could see this coming, okay? And what it meant in the winter of 50-51 is that the Soviets had yet an additional incentive to bring matters to a head before it was too late. Right? Right? It increased the fact that we made these dramatic rearmament decisions. This increased the risk of a general nuclear war, well beyond what it otherwise would have been. It was understood the Soviets would find it hard to just sit on their hands while the balance was being utterly transformed from one in which they had some chance of winning a war to one in which America could just utterly destroy them. They couldn't do scarcely anything to us in exchange. Okay, all right. And we understood all of this. So that was another reason why this winter of 50-51 was so scary. But we made the decision anyway, regardless of the risk. And then we did something else. Because the notion was, we shouldn't have to bear the entire burden of defending Europe by ourselves. We had these Europeans that should contribute to the defense of their own continent. And not just the British and the French and, you know, the Dutch and the Belgians and so on, but the West Germans. You needed to harness West German power to the Western military system in order to provide an effective defense of Europe. And you needed to provide an effective defense of Europe, because you couldn't expect the Europeans to side with you in a war, or even to risk a war, if they were going to be overrun at the very beginning of the war and destroyed in the course of the war. Western Europe had to be defended. The America couldn't do the job all by herself. She shouldn't have to do the job all by herself. You know, this is a joint effort. We're defending the values of the West as a whole. West Germany should come in. And this was the policy that the U.S. government pursued during this very dark period, the end of 1950. Secretary of State Dean Acheson is a very bellicose, hawkish individual. And despite all these risks, he pushed the Europeans at the New York Conference in September of 1950 to accept the rearmament of Germany. Europeans, especially the French, they're not against the idea that German power would ultimately be integrated into the West. They wanted Germany to be rearmed, but only after the Western political and military system had taken shape. Only after a system had been brought into being that would allow Europe to defend itself against the Soviet attack. Only then should you do it. Because if you did it now, when the West was weak, well, that would be provocative vis-a-vis the Soviets. You know, the risk was already very great, and here you might be pushing them over the edge. And this is a fear that was shared by a lot of people in the American government at the time, and a very, very valid, legitimate fear, in fact. So what happened? We're really on the verge of a war here. The Europeans resist the Acheson pressure. Not just the French, but the Germans as well. And the basic argument that they make is you can't ask Germany to rearm and become an ally if Germany is still being treated as an occupied country. Don't forget, the occupation statute is still in effect. Gives the Western powers all the rights of occupying powers in Germany. Germans say, if we're going to make a real contribution, we have to be, have our political rights restored. We have to have the whole political relationship between us and the three Western powers change in some fairly dramatic ways. Okay. And then there's the whole question of, if German power is going to be allowed to revive, what sort of structure would be used to limit what the Germans could do, which was desirable both in its own terms, because countries like France were worried about what would happen if Germany became too strong, but also to avoid giving provocation to the Soviets. So the French came up with this plan in December of 1950 for a European army that would include all these German contingents, but would prevent Germany from using the military power it could generate for its own national political purposes. But all these things, they're very kind of complex issues. You know, if Germany is going to be integrated in the European army and have its ability to pursue an independent policy limited, doesn't that also apply to France? And what about Britain? And how are they going to come into this thing? How are you going to restore these political rights to Germany? And how far are you going to go? And how much pressure do you feel you're under? And so on. All of the complexity of the issue meant that there were plenty of chances for delay. And in fact, the whole process leading to a settlement between the Western powers and Germany was slow. It was deliberately slowed down for these political reasons. Okay? And that meant that it was possible to defeat Acheson's pressure for a rapid German rearmament and to delay the big decisions until after Western power had been totally built up as a result of the rearmament decisions made at the end of 1950. Meaning that by 1952, the West now has a free hand to construct a political system. A political system whose outlines are by no means clear. Are the Americans going to stay in Europe forever? How is German power going to be constrained, if at all? You know, all of these kinds of issues, right? And finally, only in 1954 are they able to build such a system. This is the system of what was called the Paris Accords. So I'm going to end the lecture here today in about 1952, and then we're going to talk about the kind of system that came into being in 1954 and whether it offered the chance for a stable international order. Okay.